Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
It was the middle of February, and I was biking my daily five laps around what remained of Prospect Park in Brooklyn. The park, like the world around it, teetered on the brink of the abyss. Economic collapse had devastated New York City, causing a shutdown of most city services, including the subway system, all but paralyzing the city. Much the same level of disruption rippled through the rest of the country. Recovery from what had been coined the Great Debacle became all the more difficult because of the nefarious behavior of our computers. It was not quite an artificial intelligence revolt as much as machines running amok, unleashing chaos among the people who birthed them into this world. They no longer could be trusted to do what they were built for, a trait that felt eerily human. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Phil M. Cohen, author of Nick Bone's Underground. It's the near future, and the country has collapsed in what has become known as the Great Debacle, or the GD. Professor Nick Friedman, who moonlights as private detective Nick Bones, is asked to find a guy who seems to have disappeared. In his first stop is a prison, followed by a visit to the Velvet Underground, formerly known as part of the NYC subway system. There he encounters an alternative society, but he also gets a hint of how difficult the search is going to be. The missing man was a chemist who created the world's most popular drug, or it was popular until it started putting users into a coma. Hi, Phil. Thanks for joining me today.
It's great to be here. Great to talk to you.
So while you were accumulating all of your advanced degrees, did you always dream of writing a dystopian detective novel?
Well, I've been thinking about this story for a very long time. And yeah, you know, dystopian fiction is something I guess I've always gravitated toward. 1984, Brave New World, and that sort of thing. So my book is a modest contribution to that.
How much does Professor Nick Friedman, your protagonist, who is a philosopher, how much does he have in common with you?
Yeah, so the idea of dystopian science fiction, I guess, is something I've always gravitated toward. When I was in high school, I read 1984 at least twice and Brave New World. And lots of science fiction has that kind of dystopian flavor to it. And so when I dreamed up this novel, it kind of fits into that way of viewing the world. It's a kind of a dark way of looking at the world, but there's always, not always, but there's often a certain amount of light at the end of it. And I think at the end of my book, there is something of light, even though the reality doesn't change substantially.
What does a philosopher like Professor Nick Friedman, why does he become a PI? And what was his genesis? How did you create him?
Well, how I created him, I can't really say. Except that when I write, and this, I read about this from other writers as well. to a certain extent, I let the character lead me on. I mean, I knew he was he fits into detective fiction in certain ways. You know, he's tired. He's a tired guy, smart guy. He gets into the detective business because he's kind of tired in his life as a professor, and he gets one dramatic case, which not only gets him some press, but it also gets him the nickname Nick Bones, which is also the title of the book, in the title of the book.
Hmm. Artificial intelligence plays a big role in the book. Can you say more about Maggie?
Yeah, Maggie is really, according to a lot of people who read the book, is the most fun character, the most interesting character in the book. And she's a disembodied computer, disembodied AI, not in a body like, say, Data in Star Trek The Next Generation. Nevertheless, in written form, of course, I've got the opportunity to create a character who I think is genuinely female, and who is really has a terrific sense of humor, has a great curiosity, has a deep religiosity, and is also an important sidekick to Nick Friedman in terms of solving the mystery, getting things done. She has very little to do with actual artificial intelligence science, except in some very, very vague ways. It's an opportunity. It's a really good device to create a character that is a little more omnipotent and omniscient. Well, not even omnipotent, as it turns out, but omniscient than an ordinary human being. And a great conversation partner with Nick Friedman.
I love her. I want one too. Anyway, Mingus is another one of your colorful characters. Why does he choose to become homeless? And why does he decide to become Ezekiel?
Oh, well, he doesn't decide to become Ezekiel. That happens in a mysterious way that I leave unresolved. One of the things about writing fiction, you don't necessarily need to resolve all the issues that arise. But he's a character who, he's one of Nick Friedman's best students and writes a brilliant dissertation, but at the end of it, he moves into the reality that we're actually moving into in our world and finding that there are no, he did something in religion, the study of religion, and he moves into the world and he finds there are no jobs. And he's all, because he's done such a good job in writing his dissertation, he expects a job, he feels he owes a job, he's owed a job, and it drives him nuts. And it drives him so nuts that he can't function anymore. He and his family, he divorces his wife, or his wife divorces him, and he takes up residence in Nick Friedman's foyer. And Nick kind of takes care of him as a former student.
This all takes place after the GD. Can you talk about that?
Well, I call it the Great Debacle, but I kind of leave that hanging in the air, and somebody criticized me for it in one of my Amazon reviews, you know, don't know what the Great Debacle is. And I started thinking, like, you know, if you read 1984, you don't exactly know how you got to that reality, but it is. And you read Brave New World, you don't exactly know how you got to that reality. The Great Debacle, all we know is it's a terrible economic disaster that's had a terrible impact, at least on New York City, which is where the book mostly takes place, at least in New York City. And it raises all kinds of difficulties. But what it is exactly, I don't know.
It doesn't take a lot of imagination to understand what that means, the Great Debacle. Also, you might make it clear in future books in the series. So there's that.
Yeah, I'm working on the sequel, and the Great Debacle is still hanging over New York City. And in fact, it's worse.
Sorry to hear about it.
It's worse.
Do you think Gen Z and millennials and future generations will get your references, like, for example, to the Velvet Underground? And can you say more about what happens when the subway system collapses?
Well, I don't know about the cultural references to people who are not baby boomers. If people beyond the baby boom read the book, at least I hope they'll have some tolerance for these references if they don't get it. Although I hope they get the Velvet Underground. I mean, there's a great new movie on Apple TV, great documentary about the Velvet Underground, one of my favorite old rock and roll groups. But the whole New York City stops functioning properly. There's kind of minimal functioning going on. There's still cabs, although they're in really bad shape, for example. And so what's happened is there's this civilization that grows beneath New York City. And I actually borrowed that from a reality. There is a very small civilization group of people anyway, homeless people who do live beneath New York City. They get the nickname the mole people. So I took that idea and I grew it to an actual functioning civilization with governance and law enforcement and trade and all that kind of thing. And it's a little ambiguous, and I made that on purpose. It has this reputation above ground as being a horrible place, diabolical. And when the character Nick Friedman goes below and he's afraid that he's about to be, about to encounter some real violence, it turns out it's not exactly utopian. It turns out it's not utopian, but it's pretty damn civilized. And it's a place where people who are having trouble above ground functioning economically and socially, they retreat to the Velvet Underground. And it turns out that the name is well deserved. It's underground, and it's a kind of a velvet sort of civilization.
Let's talk about Lurbs. Why is it so popular? And why did only 170 people become victims?
Only 170 people? I don't think that's right.
Oh, I thought that's what it said.
No.
Were in hospitals. 170 were in hospitals, maybe.
No, they were in this one hospital. The world has got it. All right, so there's this drug. The villain of the book... the villain of the book, Shmuley Shimer, is a brilliant chemist. And even when he was in high school, he was playing around with making a designer drug. And in college or in graduate school, he perfected it. It's a combination of a real downer and a hallucinogen. And the downer part, the sedative part of the drug, enables the hallucinogenic part to be really more powerful even than LSD. But what happens is, it turns out that the drug becomes so popular, it makes Shmuley Shimer and his partner Esther Lacey very wealthy, billionaires. That's how popular the drug is. But it turns out if one takes this drug more than a certain number of times, I think it's 40 in the book, they have a very significant chance of going into a permanent, irreversible coma. And so what happens is people start going into comas. This is all before the book. This is before the reality of the book. And the world is dotted with Lurb hospitals where people who have gone into these comas are housed by the state. And I think the 170 may be the number of people in this one particular hospital where Nick Friedman's daughter lies, having been a victim of this drug.
Mm-hmm. What's up with Esther Lacey? Why did only she get sent up the river?
So Esther Lacey was Shmuley Shimer's business partner, without whom Lurbs would not have been circulated as widely as they were. But when they get arrested, this is during the beginning of the Great Debacle, and the legal system is a little bit in disarray. Shmuley Shimer, turns state's evidence on Esther Lacey, so she gets to take the rap, and Shmuley Shimer supposedly goes off on the witness relocation program. But that's the whole setup of the book. He supposedly goes off on the witness relocation program, but promises his father, in kind of classical detective fiction style, he promises his father that he'd be in touch with the father once, just to let him know he's arrived at whatever destination he's going to safely, but he never does. And so the father goes to Nick Friedman. Shmuley and Nick Friedman are old yeshiva buddies. They're old high school buddies. And the father knows that Nick Friedman, because of this one case that he cracked and got a lot of fame, he knows that Nick Friedman does detective work. So he goes to the high school buddy, Nick Friedman, and asks him to find Shmuley Shimer. But what happens, that you have to read the book to find out.
Right. Can you explain web houses? Nick uses one after he trips out.
Well, I mean that's real. Oh, well, there's two levels. At one level, it's, you know, they're not so common anymore, but they used to be much more common. You know, I forget what you call them. You know, you don't have a computer, you go to a place where there's a bunch of computers and you can rent them by the hour. But what's happened, and this is a bit of advanced technology that still survives in this great economic debacle, is you can go rent a room, and the availability and the sophistication of websites has really become much more intense than even now. And I guess I can say this about the book. So one of the, also in classic detective trope fashion, Nick Friedman gets dosed. He gets a triple dose of this drug Lurbs, and he's got to figure out how to take care of himself. So he goes to a web house, he rents a room, he calls up his computer, Maggie, who takes care of him, and she's his guide throughout the webiverse in a way that helps him both come down from the trip, enjoy the trip, and then something during that trip happens that pushes the plot forward.
Okay. Why does Simone Hartwig tell Nick that the Velvet Underground is the only vestige of decency left in New York?
Well, because she's a former New York City policewoman who finds things above ground to be just in growing more and more intolerable, and not just economically, but politically as well. And that's a piece, by the way, drop a hint, that's a piece that gets developed more in the sequel. And she discovers the Velvet Underground as a place where there's a higher degree of civilization than above ground, although, as I said earlier, it's still a little ambiguous. And so it's a little ambiguous, but she finds life down in the Velvet Underground much more congenial, much more civilized. But she doesn't move down there permanently because her mother is still alive, but in physical impairment to the degree that she won't go down with Simone. So Simone comes above ground every now and then.
She also says something that I'm wondering if this is also author Phil M. Cohen's thought about the world. And I quote, "Philosophy that's worth anything is about ethics."
Oh yeah, yeah. That's the heart of Jewish ethics, and I learned that from my teachers, and from people I read. If philosophy is going to be important, it has to be engaged in the ethical. It's also good, Immanuel Levinas, by the way. It's certainly not my own invention, but it's right. It's got to conduce toward helping people to understand and do the good.
So you do follow that path as well.
Well, yeah.
That is you. Okay. Just want to make sure it's not only Simone. I'm guessing that Rabbi Schmelzer and the Schmelzerite movement is loosely based on another Hasidic movement that established programs and centers all over the world. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, this is a part. I'm really glad you brought this up because I think this is an interesting and important part of the book. But this is part of the book that falls outside of, you know, sort of normal sci-fi and mystery tropes. But it's an important part of the book, and I think it meshes with the rest of the book quite nicely. But it is a bit of a parody on Chabad Lubavitch, and so you hinted at that, and that's what it is. But one doesn't have to know Chabad Lubavitch to get what's going on or to see how I'm using it, because I'm using it both to parody this Hasidic movement, but it's also a way of raising questions about what's true and what's not true, what's religion and what's not good religion, what's exploitation, and what's real about religion. And the characters that are in that part of the book, I think, are both instructive in that way, and I'd like to think funny. I'd like to think that one of the things I do in this book, and one of the things I have a talent for, is developing humor in a number of different ways, both physical and dialogical. And this thing, there's a Hasidic group called the Kolbeners, which is entirely fictional. When Hasidism was born, different people would go to different cities and they would take on the name of the city to name their group, their sect. And what happens is the Kolbeiner Rebbe dies. And I guess I won't go into great detail about it, but the group morphs. The group morphs into something totally different, sort of really new agey and kind of goofy. And that's part of the fun, part of the book, but it's also part of the, it's got a serious component to it, raising questions, as I say, about the nature of religion. And I'm not anti-religious, by the way, but I am anti-phony baloney religion. And that's part of what this book talks about.
The name itself is hysterical, the Schmeltzerites. I was wondering if you had like an enemy in high school named Meltzer, and then you made it into Schmeltzer. I don't know.
No, there is a real Schmeltzer out there, and if he ever hears about this book, I might have some splaining to do.
Right. I won't say anything. So there's this whole interesting section about Nick, when he's a kid, having an identity crisis, and he actually goes to speak with the Kolbeiner Rebbe before he dies. And there's a little bit of weirdness. There's a little bit of question about the Kolbeiner Rebbe's ability to see into Nick's soul. Can you address that?
It's how that evolves later on. This part of the book. Nick is finishing high school. He's a yeshiva student. He's in a modern Orthodox yeshiva, loosely based on the yeshiva of Flatbush, and he's in his senior year of high school, and is trying to figure out, do I stay in the religious world or do I step out into the secular world and go to university and take my yarmulke off, as he says. And the chapter where he visits with the Rebbe tries to give him some advice, and ultimately the character is unable to take the advice. But it's a very, I like to think it's a very poignant chapter, where in the end the Rebbe and he stand up and the Rebbe embraces him and gives him a card, gives him a business card. And he says, call me even on Shabbos, on Saturday, which no Orthodox rabbi would normally offer, unless he views it as a case of saving a life. So even in the case of, even on Shabbos, he'll see me, Nick Friedman remarks. The book's written in the first person. What happens later, that's up to the reader to see. But there's a long-lasting relationship between the two, but never again do they meet in person or talk on the phone or Skype or Zoom. It's all through written work.
Right, but Nick is clearly a part of this whole story, even before he's a part by being hired, even before Shmuley's father asks him to find his son.
You mean because of his connection with the Kolbeiner Rebbe and how
he already was in that world, and he already understood the players. He understood what was happening.
He understood the players. Okay, in the book, he's a scholar of the Kolbeiner Rebbe's, and when the Kolbeiner people become the Schmeltzerites, he becomes a scholar of them too. So he knows them. He knows them from a scholarly way, but also because he's got at least one important contact. A fellow at the university, I think he's an astrophysicist, I don't remember for sure, but somebody in physics who's nevertheless a part of this Hasidic world, who's kind of like his, what's the word? It's kind of like his informant, constantly bringing him information about what's going on, and especially during the transition from a traditional Hasidic group to this sort of new agey group.
It's a hysterical book. I read it Saturday afternoon in one sitting, couldn't get up. So I was on Lerbs, apparently. Anyway, so imaginative.
Thank you.
A lot of fun.
Thank you.
So you're working on the second one now?
I'm working on the sequel, and it opens up. I'm not going to tell you much about it, except that Nick's in a bad way. He's in a really bad way. He's not leaving his apartment. He's a little depressed, and it's just Nick in his apartment and Maggie, and things start happening. And that's as much as I want to say, except that I'm hard at work at it, and I hope to be finished with it sometime in the spring.
Let's talk then. Thanks so much for joining me today,
okay.
Phil.
A quick commercial announcement, though. I'm glad, first of all, I'm glad you read the book, and I'm glad you read it so seriously. But I also need to let people know, if you want to get on my email list, just go to my email, my website, philmcohen.com, philmcohen.com. And if you sign up, you get an ebook with 6 short stories of mine.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Phil M. Cohen about his dystopian mystery, Nick Bones Underground. Hope you're all able to lose yourself in a good book today and tomorrow, too. Happy reading, everyone.